Audible Frontiers presents The Claw of the Conciliator, written by Gene Wolfe and narrated by Jonathan Davis.
But strength still goes out from your thorns, and from your abysses the sound of music. Your shadows lie on my heart like roses, and your nights are like strong wine. Chapter 1. The Village of Saltus. Morwenna's face floated in the single beam of light, lovely and framed in hair dark as my cloak. Blood from her neck pattered to the stones. Her lips moved without speech. Instead, I saw framed within them, as though I were the Increate, peeping through his rent in eternity to behold the world of time. The farm, Stakis, her husband, tossing in agony upon his bed, little Chad at the pond, bathing his fevered face. Outside Eusebia, Morwenna's accuser howled like a witch. I tried to reach the bars to tell her to be quiet, and at once became lost in the darkness of the cell. When I found light at last, it was the green road stretching from the shadow of the piteous gate. Blood gushed from Dorcas's cheek, and though many screamed and shouted, I could hear it pattering to the ground. Such a mighty structure was the wall, that it divided the world as the mere line between their covers does two books. Before us now stood such a wood as might have been growing since the founding of Earth, trees as high as cliffs, wrapped in pure green. Between them lay the road, grown up in fresh grass, and on it were the bodies of men and women. A burning carriole tainted the clean air with smoke. Five riders sat on destriers whose hooked tushes were encrusted with lazulite. The men wore helmets and capes of indanthrene blue and carried lances whose heads ran with blue fire. Their faces were more akin than the faces of brothers. On these riders, the tide of travelers broke as a wave on a rock, some turning left, some right. Dorcas was torn from my arms, and I drew Terminus Est to cut down those between us, and found I was about to strike Master Malrubius, who stood calmly, my dog Triskel at his side, in the midst of the tumult. Seeing him so, I knew I dreamed, and from that knew, even while I slept, that the visions I had had of him before had not been dreams. I threw the blankets aside. The chiming of the carillon in the bell tower was in my ears. It was time to rise, time to run to the kitchen pulling on my clothes, time to stir a pot for Brother Cook and steal a sausage bursting, savory and nearly burned, from the grill. Time to wash, time to serve the journeyman, time to chant lessons to myself before Master Palaemon's examination. I woke in the apprentice's dormitory, but everything was in the wrong place. A blank wall, where the round port should have been, a square window, that should have been a bulkhead. The row of hard, narrow cots was gone, and the ceiling too low. Then I was awake. Country smells, much like the pleasant odors of flower and tree that used to float across the ruined curtain wall from the necropolis, but mixed now with the hot reek of a stable, drifted through the window. The bells began again, ringing in some campanile not far away, calling the few who retained their faith to beseech the coming of the new sun, though it was very early still. The old sun had hardly dropped Earth's veil from his face, and Save for the bells, the village lay silent. As Jonas had discovered the night before, our water ewer held wine. I used some to rinse my mouth, and its astringency made it better than water. But I still wanted water to splash on my face and smooth my hair. Before sleeping, I had folded my cloak, with the claw at the center, to use for a pillow. I spread it now, and remembering how Adjia had once tried to slip her hand into the saber tash on my belt, thrust the claw into my boot top. Jonas still slept. In my experience, people asleep look younger than they do awake. But Jonas seemed older, or perhaps only ancient. He had the face, with straight nose and straight forehead, that I have often noted in old pictures. I buried the smoldering fire in its own ashes and left without waking him. By the time I had finished refreshing myself from the bucket of the inn-yard well, the street before the inn was no longer silent, but alive with hooves that splashed through the puddles left by the previous night's rain, and the clacking of scimitar horns. Each animal was taller than a man, black or piebald, rolling-eyed and half-blinded by the coarse hair that fell across its face. Morwenna's father, I remembered, had been a drover. It was possible this herd was his, though it seemed unlikely. I waited until the last lumbering beast had passed and watched the men ride by. There were three, dusty and common-looking, flourishing iron-tipped goads longer than themselves, and with them, their hard, watchful, low-bred dogs. Inside the inn once more, I ordered breakfast and got bread warm from the oven, newly churned butter, pickled duck's eggs, and peppered chocolate beaten to a froth. This last a sure sign, though I did not know it then, that I was among people who drew their customs from the north. Our hairless gnome of a host, who had no doubt seen me in conversation with the alcalde the night before, hovered over my table, wiping his nose on his sleeve, inquiring about the quality of each dish as it was served, though they were all, in truth, very good, promising better food at supper, and condemning the cook, who was his wife. He called me sir, not because he thought as they sometimes had Nessus that I was an exultant incognito, but because a torturer here, as the efficient arm of the law, was a great person. Like most peons, he could conceive of no more than one social class higher than his own.
The bed, it was comfortable. Plenty of quilts. We will bring more.
My mouth was full, but I nodded.
Then we shall. Will three be enough? You and the other sieur, are you comfortable together?
I was about to say that I would prefer separate rooms. I thought Jonas no thief, but I was afraid the claw might be too much of a temptation for any man, and I was unused, moreover, to sleeping double, when it occurred to me that he might have difficulty paying for a private accommodation.
You will be there today, sir, when they break through the wall? A mason could take down the ashlars, but Barnock's been heard moving inside and may have strength left. Perhaps he's found a weapon. Why, he could bite the mason's fingers if nothing else.
Not in an official capacity. I may watch if I can.
Everyone's coming.
The bald man rubbed his hands, which slithered together as if they had been oiled.
There's to be a fair, you know. The alcalde announced it. He's got a good head for business, our alcalde has. You take the average man. He'd see you here in my parlor and never think of a thing. Or at least, no more than to have to put an end to Morwenna. Not ours. He sees things. He sees the possibilities of them. You might say that in the wink of an eye, the whole fair sprang up out of his head. Colored tents and ribbons, roast meat and spun sugar all together. Today? Why, today, We'll open the sealed house and pull Barnock out like a badger. That will warm them up. That will draw them for leagues around. Then we'll watch you do for Morwenna and that country fellow. Tomorrow, you'll begin on Barnock.
Hot irons you start with usually, don't you? And everybody will want to be there.
The day after, finish him off and fold the tents. It doesn't do to let them hang about too long after they've spent their money, or they begin to beg and fight and so on. All well planned, all well thought out. There's an alcalde for you.
I went out again after breakfast and watched the alcalde's enchanted thoughts take shape. Country folk were stumping into the village with fruits and animals and bolts of home-woven cloth to sell. Among them were a few autochtons, carrying fur pelts and strings of black and green birds killed with the serbotana. Now I wished I still had the mantle Adja's brother had sold me, for my Philogen cloak drew some odd looks. I was about to step inside once more when I heard the quick step of marching feet, a sound familiar to me from the drilling of the garrison in the citadel, but which I had not heard since I had left it. The cattle I had watched earlier that morning had been going down to the river, there to be herded into barges for the remainder of their trip to the abattoirs of Nessus. These soldiers were coming the other way, up from the water. Whether that was because their officers felt the march would toughen them, or because the boats that had brought them were needed elsewhere, or because they were destined for some area remote from Gaihol, I had no way of knowing. I heard the shouted order to sing as they came into the thickening crowd, and almost together with it, the thwacks of the vintners' rods and the howls of the unfortunates who had been hit. The men were Kilau, each armed with a sling with a 2-cubit handle and each carrying a painted leather pouch of incendiary bullets. Few looked older than I, and most seemed younger. But their gilded brigandines and the rich belts and scabbards of their long daggers proclaimed them members of an elite corps of the Erentarii. Their song was not of battle or women as most soldiers' songs are, but a true slinger song. Insofar as I heard it that day, it ran thus. When I was a lad, my mother said, "You dry your tears and go to bed. I know my son will travel far, born beneath a shooting star." In after years, my father said, as he pulled my hair and knocked my head, "They mustn't whimper at a scar who are born beneath a shooting star." A mage I met, and the mage he said, "I see for you a future red. Fire and riot, raid and war, oh, born beneath a shooting star." A shepherd I met, and the shepherd said, "We sheep must go where we are led, to Dawngate, where the angels are, following the shooting star." And so on, verse after verse, some cryptic, as it seemed to me, some merely comic, some clearly assembled purely for the sake of the rhymes, which were repeated again and again.
"A fine sight, aren't they?"
It was the innkeeper, his bald head at my shoulder.
"Southerners, notice how many have yellow hair and dotted hides. They're used to cold down there, and they'll need to be in the mountains. Still, the singing almost makes you want to join them. How many, would you say?"
The baggage mules were just coming into view, laden with rations and prodded forward with the points of swords. 2,000? Perhaps 2,500?
"Thank you, sir. I like to keep track of them. You wouldn't believe how many I've seen coming up our road here. But precious few going back. Well, that's what war is, I believe. I always try to tell myself they're still there. I mean, wherever it was they went, but you know and I know there's a lot that have gone to stay. Still, the singing makes a man want to go with them."
I asked if he had news of the war.
"Oh, yes, sir. I've followed it for years and years now,
though the battles they fight never seem to make much difference, if you understand me. It never seems to get much closer to us, or much farther off, either. What I've always supposed was that our autarch and theirs appoints a spot to fight in, and when it's over, they both go home. My wife, fool that she is, don't believe there's a real war at all.
The crowd had closed behind the last mule driver, and it thickened with every word that passed between us. Bustling men set up stalls and pavilions, narrowing the street and making the press of people greater still. Bristling masks on tall poles seemed to have sprouted from the ground like trees. "Where does your wife think the soldiers are going, then?" I asked the innkeeper.
"Looking for Vodalus, that's what she says. As if the autarch, whose hands run with gold and whose enemies kiss his heel, would send his whole army to fetch a bandit."
I scarcely heard a word beyond Vodalus. "Whatever I possess, I would give to become one of you, who complain every day of memories fading. My own do not. They remain always, and always as vivid as at their first impression, so that once summoned, they carry me off spellbound. I think I turned from the innkeeper and wandered into the crowd of pushing rustics and chattering vendors. But I saw neither them nor him. Instead, I felt the bone-strewn paths of the necropolis under my feet, and saw through the drifting river fog the slender figure of Vodalus as he gave his pistol to his mistress and drew his sword. Now, it is a sad thing to have become a man. I was struck by the extravagance of the gesture. He who had professed in 100 clandestine placards to be fighting for the old ways, for the ancient high civilization Earth has now lost, has discarded the effectual weapon of that civilization. If my memories of the past remain intact, perhaps it is only because the past exists only in memory. Vodalus, who wished as I did to summon it again, yet remained a creature of the present. That we are capable only of being what we are remains our unforgivable sin. No doubt, if I had been one of you whose memories fade, I would have rejected him on that morning as I elbowed my way through the crowd, and so in some fashion would have escaped this death in life that grips me even as I write these words. Or perhaps I would not have escaped at all. Yes, more likely not. And in any case, the old recalled emotions were too strong. I was trapped in admiration for what I had once admired, as a fly in amber remains the captive of some long-vanished pine.